Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife. Larry Mailer here, and pleased to have back David Drake and Jamie Knack. David's a UW Extension wildlife specialist and professor. David, good to see you.
Larry, good to see you. Thanks for having us back.
Yeah, Jamie Knack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Jamie, good to see you as well.
Great to be back. Thanks, Larry.
Both are with Extension and with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus. And we got lots to talk about. We can talk about community science. We can talk about the Franklin's ground squirrel. We can talk about all the herps you may or may not be seeing running around these days. Well, not running.
But some are.
Some are. Some are sliding or whatever along. Yeah. And I hope you'll join in. There's lots that we can talk about. Maybe you've got an interesting sighting or maybe just a question about some wildlife in your area. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Jamie, the DNR is asking the public to report sightings of several wildlife species, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, let's start with the Franklin ground squirrels. And unfortunately, we only have a couple more weeks, probably, realistically, to see and sight them and report them. And I say that because they're a true hibernating species of squirrel. That being said, they'll be back on the landscape again in April, or perhaps you're a private landowner who has recognize this squirrel, and you can certainly report those sightings, even though they may be hibernating shortly. So
they look a little like a gray squirrel, don't they?
There's a number of squirrels species in Wisconsin. We often group them by whether they're a tree squirrel, like the common gray squirrel, fox squirrel, and red squirrel, or whether they're a ground squirrel, the chipmunk or the 13-line ground squirrel that most people refer to as a gopher would be examples of the ground squirrel. So the Franklin's, it is similar in size to a gray squirrel, but it has a little bit shorter tail and a little bit flatter of a tail. And then I would describe it as being mottled or specked across the back. And it also has a white eye ring. And so this is primarily a squirrel that spends time on the ground, although only about 10% of the time is it above ground. So lots of time below ground. Some of that time is obviously hibernating. And then it's primarily diurnal and associated with tall grass prairies. It likes the more shrubby habitat close to woodlands. Historically would be found from the northwest part of Wisconsin to the southeast corner. More recently, it's been in central Wisconsin and the northwest corner. So they're really curious to see where these populations may be and being able to protect them then. So because they're elusive, rather secretive, they also are pretty sedentary. They only stay or travel about 100 meters away from their burrow. They can be pretty hard to see. And they like the tall grass prairie. I think there's some protection from predators. Yeah. And some of their predators would be red-tailed hawks and coyotes and fox, and even a mink or a badger would all be predators for them. So,
And they're a point of interest. So if someone sees one or sees or knows them.
Yes. If you think you've seen a Franklin's ground squirrel on your property, if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and you just type in rare mammal reporting form, there will be a way to just electronically submit that observation. If you did get a picture or even a trail camera picture, you can upload that and they'd really appreciate that as well. And that's true of any other rare mammals too. So if you happen to see even a badger, you know, those reportings would be important. So the Franklin ground squirrel is a species of conservation concern. We're kind of on the edge, the eastern edge of their range. They're more prevalent and common in the Dakotas or western states. Really big predator of duck nests. When I had done some research or some work many years ago out in the Dakotas searching for duck nests, they were one of the common species of predators on those duck nests, both the nestlings and the eggs themselves. So,
and I know the state of Iowa, their DNR has them as endangered, I think.
Yes. Yep. And so it's kind of a retraction of their range. And we want to, if we can figure out where they are, then we can be in a better position to protect that habitat and restore those populations.
Okay. So the Franklin ground squirrel and other potentials, as you mentioned, that like a badger, perhaps.
Yep.
Although badgers are pretty much in every county, aren't
yeah,
they?
We yeah, we do have reports of them in every county. We don't have a great index of their current population numbers, but they're well distributed. And a lot of that information does come from either the Snapshot Wisconsin program, which we've talked about, the mm-hmm. grid of trail cameras across the state, or through records of people who are reporting the sightings.
Yeah.
But badgers, like the Franklin ground squirrel, being fossorial or living under the ground,
yeah,
you know, they're hard to see because they're under the ground, and badgers are nocturnal a lot of times. So unlike the ground squirrels, which are diurnal, which are active during the day, but they're just difficult to see. So that's part of it, is that they're trying to just get an idea about population status, both with badgers and Franklin's ground squirrels, so they can better manage the population, better manage the habitat.
Yeah, been around a long time, and I've only seen one in the wild,
yeah,
and that was on a pheasant hunting trip. I just got lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
Just got lucky. Joe in Vilas County has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Hey, question for you. I've seen this my whole life, but it's been a little bit more extreme just recently, and shrews dead on the road. Now, I got a couple ideas of what might be causing it, but I wanted to get your opinion. It doesn't look like they're getting run over by cars. I live on a street. It's a blacktop, and there's probably three people living on the street now, so it's not a ton of traffic.
So not to doubt you, but could you describe the animal just to make sure we are talking about a shrew?
Yeah, you know, the short pointy nose, the short kind of slicked fur, not much of a tail.
Yep. Yep. Okay.
I'm 90% sure it's a shrew.
Yeah. So that would be, it sounds like a northern short-tailed shrew, which is a common species we have in Wisconsin. There's six shrew species in the state. Shrews and northern short-tailed shrews in particular, they will eat other small mammals like mice and chipmunks and things like that. And an interesting fact about northern short-tailed shrews is they have a very small amount of venom that is mixed in with their saliva, and they use that venom to incapacitate the larger prey that they're eating, like mice and things like that. So I don't know exactly what you're talking about or what might be the cause of that, but what I'm wondering, because you're describing seeing the whole animal, so it doesn't sound like they're being predated by an owl or a fox or anything like that, because that animal wouldn't be there or wouldn't be intact. It doesn't sound like they're getting run over by a car. So I'm wondering if, because they do eat a lot of mice, I'm wondering if they're eating mice that are have anticoagulant pesticide in them or rodenticide in them. And as they eat that mouse with the anticoagulant rodenticide, they're actually getting secondary poison. Poisoning, and so I'm wondering if that's maybe what you're seeing there. But that's the only guess I can come up with.
All right, that's a pretty good guess.
I'll take it. I'm done for the day.
Joe, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Karen in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have great concerns about the biodiversity and also the connection of everything to everything else. And there are two things that I've noticed. And one is, the other night I listened, this is the first time, on a weather report, they said that we were in the middle of a drought. And I have felt like this summer, though we had rains and rains and rains, that the ground was hard as cement. Maybe that's because I live in an urban area. Don't know. So that's one issue, is that drought. And I see trees dying. You know, mm-hmm. trees that happen to be on slight hills or where the water's not soaking in. And then the second thing that I've been very concerned about for years, I called you years ago about this, is numbers of insects. And I think birds are being really hit by the lack of those birds that eat insects. That, and you just don't see insects.
Yeah. So
and
Well, let's tackle those. David, do you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start it, and Jamie, please chime in as you wish. Yeah, so one of the issues is we are in a bit of a drought, at least in the southern part of Wisconsin, and we definitely could use some rain. We went into, we had a relatively dry winter to begin with, so we went into spring relatively dry, and then we had a pretty decent amount of rain in the spring, early summer, again, at least in the southern part of Wisconsin. But, we are having these weird fluctuations in weather, and that's a result of climate change to some extent. And so I think, unfortunately, this is probably what we're going to expect into the future is some of these weather fluctuations where we have maybe a drought year one year, and then we have record rains the next year, or maybe even have it in the same year, so to speak. So yes, it is all connected, and as you properly identified, some of the vegetation might be suffering a little bit. Most vegetation that we have here, especially native species of vegetation, are adapted to our climate, our growing conditions, and things like that. So most of the species can endure at least a short-term drought and will generally be okay in the long term. Same thing for insects, and there's a bunch of studies out there about insect populations, and it depends on the specific population you're talking about. But some populations are suffering because of insecticide use. Some populations are suffering because of habitat loss and other things like that. And it can possibly impact bird species, especially those birds that are insectivores and feed on insects such as purple martins or common nighthawks and bluebirds and things like that. But for the most part, those bird species are also not tied to a single food source and have a diversity of food that they can utilize. And so most of the bird species, especially if those bird species are in areas with concentrations of human beings and also have access to human-provided food in terms of feeding stations and bird feeders and things like that, most birds are doing pretty well. And they're not if the bird species is declining in population, they're not declining necessarily because of lack of food. They're declining because of habitat modification or habitat destruction more than a food issue.
Yeah. Anything to add there, Jamie, or are we good?
I think we're good.
And the droughts on trees, for example, as you mentioned trees, and, typically if you get a couple of years in a row, the trees get stressed.
Yeah, for sure.
It might not show up in the same year, but a year or two down the road is when you actually
for
see
sure.
it.
I was just thinking, we probably, at least here in the southern part of the state, may not have a very colorful fall foliage season simply because it's been so dang dry, unfortunately. And obviously now we've got some unseasonably warm weather, too.
Yeah. Karen, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, talking with our experts, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW-Madison and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk the world of wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Larry Mueller. And Betsy in Dodgeville called but couldn't stay with us. Betsy has seen a bobcat wearing a DNR radio collar, and she wonders if there's publicly available information so she could learn about that bobcat.
Oh, that's really a great question. And the answer is a little bit of both, yes and no. So great point. So there's been a long-standing research project in the southwestern part of the state looking at chronic wasting disease in white-tailed deer and also predators of white-tailed deer. So bobcat and coyotes were trapped and radio collars put on them. So Betsy, what I would first do is call the Dodgeville DNR office, service center, and ask to speak to the wildlife biologist and see if they are aware of that bobcat. So there's a couple of things. That radio collar may have, the battery life may have been exhausted, so they're no longer getting information from the collar itself, but they'd be very interested in documenting the sighting and knowing that it's there. And alternatively, they may have that specific collar, or that collar may be working, and I'm sure they'd be happy to tell you a little bit about the history of that bobcat. They do not publish radio frequencies or information and movements to the point that people can follow some of these collared animals. And if you think about, oh, we've got wolves, we've got elk, all sorts of animals that have collars on them. Some of those species can be hunted legally. You don't want to be putting out those frequencies and things like that. So there's an ethical question around that. And you don't want them just to be tracked and harassed as well.
Sure. So. Kathy in Mercer has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. I have a question about bats. We put up a bat house about 3 years ago. We put it on the south side in the peak of a garage. And to date, we have not had a single bat. What can I do?
Well, Kathy, thank you very much for your question. Thank you so much for putting that bat house up. We have got 8 species of bats in the state of Wisconsin. 4 of them are state resident species. And those are the 4 species that are susceptible to white nose syndrome, which has really done a pretty good job of decimating bat populations. We think here in Wisconsin, as well as throughout the United States, where white nose syndrome it occurs. So anything that you or any other members of the public can do to support bat conservation is greatly appreciated. So there's a couple of potential answers to your question. One might be that you may not have many bats around, which is possible. It may or may not be true. The other issue is the types of bats you may have around may not necessarily occupy bat houses. So not all bats occupy bat houses. The last answer to your question is it is possible that you have bats around and you've got bats that would occupy your bat house, but there's also sufficient natural habitats suitable for them, and they're taking advantage of that natural habitat and don't actually need to or haven't had any reason to occupy your bat house. So I know that's not a definitive answer to your question. If you want to try to get bats in your house, one of the things you might want to do is go to Bat Conservation International, which is a clearinghouse and a scientific organization having to do it with all things bats. And if you just Google Bat Conservation International, or I think is it batcon.org, Jamie, is the website.
It is.
They've got a tremendous resource on frequently asked questions about bat houses, and you can read through that and make sure that you, it sounds like you've positioned your bat house in the right orientation facing south, but putting your bat house a certain number of feet above the ground, for example, and some other things like that. Some other things you might want to try to do is if you can find some bat droppings or bat guano somewhere, if you can get a hold of that and you can safely access the bat house under the gable of your garage, just smear those bat droppings in the bat house, and sometimes that will attract bats as well. But I take a look at that Bat Conservation International website and just make sure that there's something that you're not missing something that might attract the bats.
Yeah, Kathy, the only other things I was thinking of quickly was in northern climates, those bat houses should be painted brown or black to absorb more of the sun's energy and create more warmth. And then you mentioned in the that you have it located on the peak and on the south side. That's all excellent. You just want to make sure also that it's getting full sun when it can, so it's not being shaded out by nearby trees or things like that. So those would just be some other things to think about.
Good things to think about.
Yeah, and maybe one last thing is just make sure you don't have predators of bats around, that they can't access that bat house, because that might be the other thing. If a snake can get in there, or owl or something like that can access that bat house, the presence of the predator may be enough to keep the bats away too.
Thank you, Kathy, for calling. Tom in Green Bay has something about those dead shrews. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Thanks for the very strange scenario about the shrew. At this time of year, in fact, all through summer, if you do any walking on roads and things like that, you're going to find dead short-tailed shrews. You're going to find some star-nosed moles. These are being caught by fox, especially young red fox. They catch them. They won't eat them because they don't taste good. Sometimes you'll find little piles of them on the edge of the road. Gray fox also do this, and also some cats do it. But more typically, that's red fox.
Hmm.
I did wonder about that because of we talked about the toxin or the toxicity of their saliva, and there are a number of predators then that won't eat them. So even folks that have indoor outdoor cats will report, shrews being spit out and not eaten. So that was another another potential thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for the listener who asked that question, then next time you see a shrew on the road, go and if you can, pick it up and maybe put a pair of gloves on to pick it up. But just examine it and see if you see tooth marks that have punctured the body. Mm-hmm. But if that's the case, that is some type of predator, you should see some kind of indication trauma. That mm-hmm. there's trauma or tooth marks that have punctured the body cavity.
Yeah. Good advice. Tom, thanks for calling. Richard in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, good morning. I think it's still morning.
Yeah, it is.
I want to ask your guest speakers. I moved up to northeastern Wisconsin, and when I first moved here and got my house, there were like nothing but black squirrels. And then within 2 or 3 years, they were all gone. And I see red squirrel here once in a while. And then just recently, I'm seeing like another proliferation of black squirrels, not on my land, but, you know, as I drive to the lake or whatever. My question is, what causes that? Mm-hmm. And not just that, what are the difference between the different squirrels?
Yeah, okay.
Sure. It's going to be a squirrel episode, Larry. So the squirrels you're talking about are, as we started the show, talking about some of the tree squirrels. So a red squirrel. The red squirrels have a white eye ring. They're the smallest of our tree squirrels, but they're super feisty. They have little attitudes and like to stomp their feet and chatter off alarm calls and so on. So usually tied to coniferous forests. And then we have the gray squirrel, which we'll see often in urban areas as well. And the fox squirrel, which is a little more orangish in color, a little bit larger than the gray squirrel and more in an agricultural woodland type setting. The black squirrel is actually a color phase of the gray squirrel. And so it's a genetic condition where they produce too much melanin and they have a melanistic trait then. So that dark black colored coat. So it's a genetic issue within that population. It's a recessive trait. And so that's why you sometimes see, especially in urban areas or where there's an abundance of gray squirrels, where you might see black squirrels from time to time. So if I just bring up, you know, with somebody that I'm talking with about black squirrels, they'll usually have a location. Oh, there's a whole bunch of them in Boulder Junction or in this town or in that town. And they tend to occur in certain areas. But whether it's natural selection, those squirrels eventually are removed from the population. And, you know, over time, there might be more. Back. And so it's very similar to an animal being an albino or mm-hmm. having a lack of pigment. Melanistic is too much pigment.
Hmm. There you go, Richard. Thank you very much for calling. Mary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. We were paddling on beautiful Lake Wingra on Monday, and near the entrance to the springs there among the lily pads, there was a bird that appeared to be ill. And I hadn't seen that kind of bird around a lot. Merlin suggested that it might be a cormorant, and it was just kind of laying there with it, or floating there with its head, kind of like it was asleep. I came pretty close to it. It didn't fly away. It would periodically perk up and look around. It paddled away a little bit, but then it stopped again. Is there a place I should report sighting a bird that looks ill, just basically to have someone check to see if it was West Nile's disease? I don't know if that species gets it, or even if there was a possibility of rescuing it. Maybe it had a condition that was pretty remedied.
Yeah, Mary, thanks for the question. I was just walking around Lake Wingra on Sunday and did not see that bird, but I did see pie-billed grebes, which was pretty cool to see those. So it is likely it's a cormorant. We typically don't have cormorants down in the southern part of the state that stay here in the summertime. They are further up north on the Great Lakes and some of the lakes in northern Wisconsin. But they are migratory, and so they're migrating through right now. And so if you want to report it, you could call the county biologist for Dane County. Julie Widholm is her name, and you can find her online if you wish to do that. You can report that bird. The DNR may or may not be interested in that. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service would be another agency that might be interested in that, as they are they have authority over migratory birds like the cormorants. And if it's just one bird, it's unlikely they're going to be interested because it's a single bird and it's not indicative of a larger population-wide issue. If you see, you know, tens or hundreds of birds, obviously then people would be interested in that. But cormorants are susceptible to a number of diseases. Newcastle disease is one of them, for example. And it is likely that occasionally there are die-offs in the cormorant population because of disease outbreaks. It is possible that this single bird may be susceptible to a certain illness, or it may have just been having a bad day and is going to be fine on its own, especially if it was you saw it swimming and things like that. Maybe it just wasn't feeling well at that particular time and will be okay on its own. But if you do want to pursue it, I would call either the Dane County Wildlife Biologist or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office in Madison.
Another possibility to call would be the Dane County Humane Society, which also has a wildlife rehabilitation arm to their center. And I'm sure a number of listeners are thinking about that potential, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not that they would have the resources to come and get it, but they may be able to field those questions or help address the situation.
Good point.
There you go, Mary. Thank you for calling. Jan in Sauk County, your turn. Hi, Jan.
I live in Sauk County, and a neighbor was telling me yesterday that her son had received a permit to hunt a bobcat. Oh. And I'm just wondering about the status of bobcats in Sauk County and in the state in general. Are they endangered? Is there a hunting season on them? What's the story?
So there is a hunting season for bobcats. There is, I believe, just two zones, a northern and a southern zone. And so this, where you are, would be the southern zone. In addition, there are two different time periods, an early season and a later season. So I don't have the dates. Oh, maybe I do have the dates in front of me. And I'll look as I'm talking here. But essentially, I don't know what a good estimate for bobcats would be right now. I would say 5,000 to 6,000 bobcats, somewhere in that ballpark. And then each year, the Department of Natural Resources sets a quota. In other words, how many bobcats they feel can be harvested in each of those zones. And then they figure out what the success rate is for harvest based on previous registration. And then they can issue a number of tags. And so the tags are tightly controlled. It's not a bag limit where you can shoot, you know, so many bobcats a day or something like that. You have to have the permit, the authorization to be able to harvest. And right now it is probably taking 4 to 6 years before you have enough preference points to be able to draw that permit. You know, that's probably a lot, but
and by the way, the period is October 19th through the 25th, period one, and the period two is December 26th through January 31st. Yeah. Joel, let me know that.
Oh, good.
Thank you. And bobcats are fur bearers, so their hunting season, you know, the pelt is part of one of the resources that you can obtain from that harvest, along with the meat can be eaten, the skull can be used and saved. And so it's important that that pelt be in prime condition as well, so it can be used to the potential. So that's why you see the fall and winter harvest for bobcat. I think it's probably around 200 or 400 bobcats, something in that range, that are harvested each year. So to answer your question, bobcat are well distributed in the state. Their populations are doing really well. They're a species that is highly regulated, probably one of the most highly regulated fur bearers in the state. They, once harvested, they do have to get registered. They look at the age of the bobcat. They record the sex. And so we know an awful lot about the trends in our bobcat populations in Wisconsin.
And the structure of the
and the structure of the population.
Yeah, there you go, Jan. Thank you so much. And again, how many? We think 5,000, 6,000.
If I were just to get within a couple thousand, I would say 5,000 to 6,000. I haven't seen a estimate, you know, recently, but
yeah, there we go. Jan, thanks again. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Wildlife question or maybe an experience to share? Love to hear from you. Let's go to Judy in Madison next. Hi, Judy.
Good morning. I'm calling with a question for David Drake.
Mm-hmm.
I live near Hoyt Park in Madison, and you did a coyote study here a couple of years ago, and I never heard what the results were about that. I heard a coyote howling not too far from my house a couple of weeks ago, and but I haven't seen any lately.
Okay.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for the question. I don't live too far from you. My fiance and I live over in the Dungeon Monroe neighborhood, and we were awoken by coyotes a couple weeks ago, about 2 a.m. We were in a dead slumber, and they just started howling. And there's probably 4 or 5 of them, and it just jolted us awake. And they howled for about a minute, turned off, but it sounded like they were in our backyard. And it was so neat to hear. So, yes, we have been, since 2014, we've been live trapping and radio collaring coyotes and red fox in Madison. We have not trapped coyotes for the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years probably. But we used to catch coyotes over in the Hoyt Park area, as well as fox over there. And the coyote population is doing well in the city of Madison. They're healthy. They're stable. They're definitely around, for sure. And so we've shared a lot of that information on our project Facebook page. So if you just go to UW Urban Canine Project and then Facebook, it's an open Facebook page. So you can look there. We do quite a few talks around the city. And one thing I will mention, not just for people in Madison, but anybody else listening that you might really find interesting, or I do at least, is if you just Google ArcGIS, so ARCGIS, and then a separate word is story map, and then a separate word is carnivores in the city. So ArcGIS is a computerized mapping program, and story map is a way to graphically demonstrate or graphically represent a story. And so the company that owns ArcGIS, they did a story map on our project, and it's a really cool representation of where foxes and coyotes are found in Madison and how they move through the city and things like that. And so I would refer you, Judy, and anybody else interested in this, just go to ArcGIS story map, a carnivore in the city, and you'll read about that. It's a fascinating thing. But for the most part, the coyotes are doing well. They're hanging out in urban green spaces like Hoyt Park, like Owen Park, UW Arboretum, Lakeshore Nature Preserve on campus, and things like that. And they're doing quite well, and they're healthy.
Do you ever equip those collars with cameras?
We don't, but a colleague of mine who's got a similar project in Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Michael Cole from the University of Georgia, he's got cameras on collars that they're putting on coyotes in Atlanta. And if you just Google the Atlanta Coyote Project, you'll find some video footage. But it is fascinating to see where these coyotes are going. I mean, they're in hotel parking lots in extremely urban areas of Atlanta, and they're I think one of the videos has got a coyote carrying one of the pups in its mouth as it's traveling across the city. And it's super cool to see what they're doing.
It's really interesting to see those videos from the coyote's perspective on how they're watching cars and people move around. And they're, you know, they're within 100, 200 yards in some cover.
Yeah.
We probably had no clue they were there. And it's them looking out. It's just, it's a really neat perspective. Yeah,
I think video, I'm sorry, Larry, really quick. Another video they've got is a coyote was in a fast food parking lot, and it's got a bag of fast food in its mouth that it's carrying someplace to eat somewhere else.
Well, now people are saying, wait a minute, where was that again? How can I see that?
Right. Yeah, Atlanta, Georgia. If you just Google the Atlanta Coyote Project or Coyote Project, you should find it. But it's really super cool.
It sounds really neat. All right, Judy, thanks again for your question. Elizabeth in Madison, your turn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about why the word harvest is used, because I think of harvest for crops, and why don't we just say hunt or kill? I don't understand that, and it seems to be like not a new term, but I've never heard it as much before in the past.
Okay.
Elizabeth, I'd be more than happy to answer that question. And that's a term that I use a lot. I have a lot of personal reasons why I choose to use the word harvest rather than kill. And I think, you know, in some ways, if we look back to Aldo Leopold and sustainable wildlife management, it was about producing a surplus of a crop. So in some ways, harvesting your vegetable crop, harvesting game is very parallel to that. For me personally, taking wildlife management classes, we look at, you know, how do you set up a harvest? We don't really talk about it. How do you set up a kill for a white-tailed deer? Or it's just not talked about that way, whether that's being sensitive to the words that we're using, or just talking in terms of from the textbooks on game management, where you're talking about harvest strategies or harvest systems and management plans and things like that. So some of it's, you know, in me, integral in me. I am a hunter. For me, when I think about killing, or I talk about I killed a deer, I shot a deer, I'm fine with that. I'm not, you know, those are semantics. The result is the same. But I personally feel so much more goes into harvesting. There I go again, right? Harvesting that deer than that last second where you're pulling the trigger or releasing an arrow or whatever it may be. There's been scouting. There's been habitat management going on, practice with your method of choice, your tool of choice. That all go into that harvest, much like growing a garden and harvesting a tomato. So again, some of it is personal, but there's some other, you know, reasons why there's a history of using the word harvest as well.
There you go, Elizabeth. Thank you very much for calling. David Drake and Jamie Nack are guests today as we talk the world of wildlife. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Talking the world of wildlife on the show today with David Drake and Jamie Nack from UW Extension and also the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. Laura emailed a photo of an animal they took yesterday in Newbold Township in Oneida County. The tail of the animal looked like a cat's tail. Is it a lynx?
Yeah, so on the photo, I can't see the tail itself. I can see from the chest cavity forward, but it is a very nice photo, and it is clearly a bobcat. Yeah. There's white spots on the back of the ears.
Yeah.
Distinguishing a bobcat from a lynx, lynx are much less common. They're a rare species in Wisconsin. We do get them occasionally. They are much longer legged and really fluffy fur on their on their feet. And sometimes people will say if they see the tufts sticking out on the ears that it's a lynx, and that's not true. Bobcat also have tufts on their ears, or certainly can. But it's a very nice picture of a bobcat, and it looks like it's from a cell phone or a camera, not a trail camera, and that's a pretty unique sighting because they're very elusive. We talked about their populations a little bit earlier, but they're just a pretty secretive animal you don't get a chance to see very often. So that was a very good sighting and a capture of a picture.
I was thinking back for many years ago. I was in southwestern Wisconsin at it was still dark out, but I was in the woods, and one howled.
Oh yeah!
Oh, it came up. I must have sensed me and let out a howl.
Your hair stood up.
Yes. Yeah, the hair on the back of your neck stands right up. I can tell you that for sure. Oh man! Yeah. Mark and Edgerton emailed to share that they harvested an antlerless deer and took the deer to the processor. In the past, a CW testing kiosk was located at the processor's business. But that's no longer the case. Mark said they had to bring the deer head sample to a Janesville DNR service station. And Mark thinks this is not good. We need to have these stations readily available to promote the testing for this disease.
Yeah, so appreciate the comment, because it gives us a chance to talk about it as well. But unfortunately, I mean, it would be wonderful if there were kiosks and dumpsters for disposal of carcasses. In every county, it's just simply a staffing, a cost issue. And I personally, you know, run into this too, where you're driving a fair distance to be able to either get a test or dispose of a carcass. But I encourage you to continue to make those arrangements and to do it. You can look on the Department of Natural Resources website to find out where there's a kiosk in your area. You could also work with conservation groups in your area or a couple of friends, and you can adopt a kiosk. So they are always looking for people to support a new location for a kiosk. But in terms of finding a new location for you to have a deer tested, whether it's being dropped off or a place where they will test right there, or collect the sample, you can go to the Department of Natural Resources website, look at CWD kiosks, and also dumpsters for the removal of carcasses, so they're not going back on the landscape.
Deb emailed asking for tips on how to remove a resident nightly visiting skunk. The wild skunk lives in the road culverts near Deb's farm and large yard, and the skunk digs for grubs and eats what falls out of the bird feeders. The skunk does not scare easily. Any tips besides live trapping and or deterrence to move the skunk along?
Yeah, it's a couple things. So that open culvert, there's not much you can do about that, because that culvert is there to allow water flow to go under the driveway or under the road. And if you were to block that off in any way, as debris is in the water, is going to block up that culvert and dam up the water. So the culvert is there. There's not much you can do about that. If you want to, you can take your bird feeders down. And right now, birds don't necessarily need you to feed them, because there's plenty of abundant natural vegetation and food for them right now, even as they're migrating. So you can take your bird feeders down, clean up all the bird seed. That will help as well. The grub damage and them digging for grubs in your yard, if you want to treat your yard for grubs, you can try to do that with a grubicide. But the damage that they do, typically skunks will not roll the turf up like a raccoon will, and they don't necessarily rototill the turf like a raccoon or a coyote or a fox will. They typically will just push their nose into the ground and create these kind of conical indentations in your ground. All of that is cosmetic, and that will all go away over time and really doesn't cause any permanent damage. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. If you do want to try to live trap the skunk, you can certainly do that. You can also kill the skunk with a firearm if you want to do that as well. You're legal to do that on property you own, as long as you can discharge that firearm. However, you need to be a certain distance off the center line of that road and certainly away from buildings you don't own. So just be aware of those regulations. But if you do live trap the skunk, the other legal caveat is you need to have permission from the landowner, be it public or private, prior to releasing the skunk on land you don't own. So just be aware of that. My recommendation is not to worry too much about the skunk. It will probably move on its own and or get killed by a predator or just die a natural cause soon enough, because skunks don't have a terribly long life, and then the problem will take care of itself.
Michael emailed to say that waterfowl bag limits that say hunters can take 20 common gallinules?
Gallinules, yeah.
Yet if you report a sighting of that bird on eBird, it often comes up as a rare species. So how was that bag limit arrived at? Do they use eBird sightings when setting the bag limits?
So I would assume a gallinule is migratory.
Yeah, it's a migratory water bird, yeah.
So we set bag limits, and I say like the federal government, Fish and Wildlife Service, sets bag limits for waterfowl based on the flyway that you're located in. So we're in the
Central Flyway.
And so they would have meetings with other states. They'd look at population numbers. If you think about band returns, those are some of the data that go into population numbers, number of birds harvested, and so on. And so then they also, some of the factors that go into setting bag limits are always going to be, you know, how many people are pursuing that animal. So, or interested in pursuing that animal. We talked about the bobcat earlier. There's more people interested in having a permit to harvest a bobcat than we can allow to sustain the bobcat population. When it comes to gallinules, they're not a very common bird for most waterfowl hunters to pursue. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you have fewer people out there, you can increase that bag limit. Coming to something like a canvasback, that's a pretty prized waterfowl, a duck, and their populations can't support a bag limit of five, you know, canvasbacks per person that's interested in hunting them. And so it's not a great answer, but it depends on the species, the interest, the harvest success. And again, it's a migratory bird.
But to add to your answer, Jamie, the amount of e-bird sightings or accounts is not taken into account when they're setting bag limits for
correct
species. So,
yep,
the e-bird, you might report that to an e-bird, and e-bird may say that's a rare sighting.
Right.
And it may be a rare sighting simply because gallinules are somewhat secretive and you don't see them all that often, although they are super cool birds.
Yep.
But the fact that e-bird says that's a rare sighting, that has no play at all when they're setting bag limits for that species.
Right, because they're managed on the fly, across the flyway, yep, across a number of states, Canada and Mexico.
Yeah, and managed with more scientific input than community science.
Very good question, though.
Yeah, it is.
Cindy emailed a still photo taken from a night video of a fox in Rock County. Given the leg markings, Cindy presumes it's a red fox. They say they have two trail cams on their property. It's been so much fun seeing what passes through. And as I look at the photo, it's black and white.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks like a red fox to me.
it probably is a red fox, especially if you are in urban areas, bordering agricultural areas, something like that, more open land. We also have gray fox here, but that's more of a forest-associated species. But, yeah, even with a black and white photo, and I'm sorry I can't see the photo right now, but on the back of the ears, it will be black. They'll have black leggings, especially on the front leg,
yeah,
and they'll have a white tip to the tail. So it's most likely a red fox because that's the more common of the two species.
Yeah. And she just adds, it's been such fun seeing what passes through.
Absolutely.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That people, trail cameras or wildlife cameras are a very common thing that everybody uses nowadays. And it is so much fun to see what's out there.
It just opens your eyes.
Yeah.
So.
And if you have any curiosity about wildlife cameras, just Google Snapshot Wisconsin, and you will see a wide variety of wildlife that's been caught on wildlife cameras across the state.
And they're not really all that expensive anymore.
$100-$150, you got a pretty decent wildlife camera.
Well, it's a pretty cool a photo for sure. I wanted to get started a little bit on herps. We're kind of getting to the top of the hour here, but this time of the year you're going to see a lot of reptiles and amphibians moving to where they hibernate. They're going to be hibernating for winter. So you're probably going to see them more frequently.
Yeah, certainly a possibility. So when we use the term herptiles, it's a collective term we use to talk about reptiles and amphibians. So for Wisconsin, reptiles are our snakes, lizards, and turtles. Our amphibians are our frogs, our one-toed species, and our salamanders. And so the reason we wanted to bring some attention to this as well is the seasonality. We have herptiles moving from their summer areas where they had young and nesting and moving to where they're going to hibernate or spend the winter again. They're not on the landscape from about October to April. They're hibernating either in the muck, below water, or underground. And now's the time where they're moving to those hibernation locations. So
yeah,
on roadways, we want to be really careful.
Yeah.
And then also just start to report those sightings. Same thing with the Franklin ground squirrels. If we can figure out where they're crossing, we can help to protect those areas.
And we can talk some more about that. I know the DNR has issued a call to report on this, and we can expand on that. We're going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Dave and Jamie. And you can join in. If you want to give a call, you can do it right now. We'll get you on right after the news. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of wildlife on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Knack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. You know, we were talking about reptiles and amphibians, and Nicole in Monona has something relating to that. So let's go there. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, so you had talked about having the, you know, the migrations was happening and to be careful on our roadways. I'm just wondering, like, in pragmatic terms, how we can do that. I just see so much roadkill, I just wish there was a different design that we could have to our highways, but obviously that's not possible in this day and age. But mm-hmm. Do you have any suggestions of, you know, how we can actually be mindful of, you know, not running these things over?
Yeah, sure.
So individually, obviously being, you know, slowing down a little bit, right, and being aware of our surroundings, but on a greater front, by reporting these locations where you're seeing this roadkill, as those reports come in and start to, if you think about like a heat map, start to show hot spots across the state of Wisconsin on some of these major highways, the Department of Natural Resource biologists can start to draw connections where, okay, there's upland habitat, there's the lowland habitat, they're crossing right here. Now, what can we do to work with the highway department to mitigate and make that a safer crossing? Some cases it could be silt fencing, it could be a culvert or different infrastructure that could help with it. It could be signage, it could be a lower speed limit at that point. So if we can identify these high risk areas, then we can start thinking about what mitigation strategies we might be able to deploy.
And there's some public thing. I mean, here in Madison, mm-hmm. isn't there, David, something with salamanders?
Shoveler Sink.
Yeah, Shoveler Sink in Middleton, the township of Middleton. Yep, they've got Timber Lane Road out there, and they've got Shoveler Sink waterfall production area. Has got a very healthy population of tiger salamanders, and when they migrate across the road in spring and summer, people put signs up and people will go out there and do a bucket brigade and actually help them across the road. And we should say that one of the things people a lot of times will do, especially with turtles, if they see crossing the roads, which are a pretty ubiquitous object, you can see those a little bit easier than you can perhaps a frog. But a lot of people have an inclination to stop and help the turtle across the road. And if you do that, certainly do that. Help them across the road in the direction they're going. Don't reverse the direction. But the other thing is just make sure that you are safe and you're not creating a traffic hazard, or you're not going to create a safety hazard for yourself or other drivers.
Yeah, now's the time of the year, too. August, September, even still into October, you may come across a turtle hatchling. Mm-hmm. So this year's turtle coming out of its nest. And I think people are tempted, oh, it's so little, you know, I'm going to help it across the road. Oh, I'll help it even further. I'll go take it to this pond. That may not be where they're going. And in addition, they need to imprint on that route for future. So it's best you can help them across the road if you can do so safely. But beyond that, just leave them in the area so they can start to imprint on that route and return there the following year.
Yeah. And last thing is, especially in the springtime, you'll see a lot of turtles on the gravel sides of roads. And before you intervene, just check and watch what they're doing, because a lot of times they're nesting. And so if they're in the process of nesting, just leave them be and go on about your way.
All right. There we go. Let's go to Nate in Lake Mills next. Hi, Nate.
Hey, I'm wondering, you know, you read about
the coy wolves in the eastern coast mostly. I'm wondering, they're spreading, is my understanding. Will they eventually arrive in Wisconsin? And it'd be nice to hear you talk about how they kind of, I think, cast into question the whole idea of what is a species.
Yeah, that's a good question, and a question, unfortunately, I think we only have about 19 minutes left. We could spend 19 hours on this question, but in particular the species. But yeah, so what do you consider a species? And I'm not a taxonomist, but people will look at genetic structure and genetic makeup, and that's what determines that species. And you'll hear sometimes people refer to this as lumpers or splitters. So sometimes they'll lump species that were historically separated, they'll lump them together because new genetic information has come to light that would suggest that these animals are actually more closely related than was historically thought. Or they might split them out because, again, more genetic information's come to light that suggests that these animals actually are not as closely related as we initially thought. And you know, with each passing year, there's new genetic techniques and methodologies that are coming up, and the amount of sophistication of genetic methodology is incredible in terms of what's being allowed in terms of monitoring genetics. So that's kind of how we would determine what a species is. And obviously a species is an animal that breeds amongst itself. It's clearly delineated in terms of what it looks like, the demography, where it lives, things of that nature. But then you can get subspecies, and so that is a kind of think about it almost as a distant cousin, if you would, in terms of human analogy. And then you get hybridization. So you may get a hybridization, and this is what we're talking about with a coy wolf, where you might have a wolf and a coyote that might breed together. That would be a hybridized animal or hybridized species. Specifically to the coy wolf issue, this is where a wolf and a coyote would breed together, and they're both in the canid family, so that is possible that they could breed together. And it has been genetically determined that that has occurred, especially in the northeastern part of the United States and up into the maritime provinces of Canada. And even though that has been documented to be a true thing, it is extremely rare that that would occur. And we do not have, as far as I'm aware, we do not have, or has not been genetically demonstrated that there's coy wolves in the Midwest or anywhere really west of the northeastern part of the United States in the maritime provinces. And if you think about this, in the canid family, so wolves, coyotes, gray fox, red fox, there's a pretty distinct hierarchy there. And wolves are about 2 to 3 times the size of a coyote. Coyotes are about 2 to 3 times the size of a red fox. And where you have wolves and coyotes that overlap, wolves will competitively exclude coyotes so that they can limit competition for select resources or limited resources. So if you think about this, because wolves typically will predate on coyotes if coyotes don't observe that competitive exclusion, that if a wolf comes across a coyote, they're much more likely to kill that coyote or chase that coyote out of the area than they are to breed that coyote. So that's why this this idea about a coy wolf just is so very uncommon.
All right. Thank you, Nate. Kelly in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I have a question for you. So my mom, about 2 summers ago, she has a cabin up by Woodruff, up between Minocqua and Lac des Flambeaux. And she got up about 5 o'clock in the morning. She looked outside, and in front of her shed, which is a little smaller than a garage, she swore she saw a black feline, but a large, large feline with a really long tail. And I have no idea. We couldn't think of what that was because she swore it was black.
Well, at that hour of the morning, it would look black.
Most things would be, right?
Right.
Right? So it is really hard. And I think, when you look at something in the daytime and then you look in that same area at nighttime, your perspective of distance is different. Your perception of size is different. And so, you know, if there was some reference on that shed that she, you know, in the future, when you see something you're not sure, is there some way you can mark, like, what's the height of that animal with a reference that you can go and look at in the daytime? We don't have any mountain lions or cougars or pumas that are black in this Great Lakes area. So while a mountain lion is always a possibility, they're very rare, but they are sighted, you know, so I you can't say never. And when you talk about a really long tail, if she's talking 3 feet long, there's not too many things that are large and have a 3 foot tail. So, but there are, you know, a raccoon can cast a big shadow, can be dark in color, a dog, a coyote. There are fisher in the Woodruff area, a black bear, short tail, right? But, you know, sometimes it's the angle, it's the lighting that, you know, I don't know that we'll ever know. If you do have, I mean, if she would have had neighbors with cameras that they could ask, if there was a chance that there was a footprint left where you could track it for a little bit, you know, all of those things, or a piece of hair, those are all things that you'd want to kind of look for. But it may be one of those cases where we'll never know, but I do feel pretty confident that it would not have been like a black
panther. If you had to take a guess, what would your guess be?
Raccoon.
Yeah, probably a raccoon.
I would maybe guess fisher, but yeah one or the other.
Fisher could be.
Fisher only because it's all black and it's got a pretty long tail.
If they saw the behavior, I think you could distinguish between fisher and raccoon.
For sure.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And, I mean, I was thinking back to Scott Craven telling the story about a guy reporting that he had a mountain lion in his, he locked it up into, it went into his house, into his barn or something, and the DNR came out and it was a cat.
Yeah, right.
A domestic cat still. Yeah. And I just say that, you know, angles, lighting, distances, your eyes play tricks on you. So.
Well, and we can cause our brain to think all sorts of different things too.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling, Kelly. Appreciate your call. Dawn in La Crosse up next. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that about a month ago, I saw a coy wolf in Wood County. It was in the same area. I had been seeing a wolf there for over a year. And then, unfortunately, he was hit by something and killed. I saw it on the side of the road. But several months later, I saw this. I saw him from behind at first, and I thought it was another wolf. He was tall, big bushy tail, and when he turned, then went in off to the side, it was absolute coyote face and body, but with very long legs. And I looked up online, and I mean, the picture was just identical to what I saw.
Dawn, I may have missed it, but what time of the year was this?
This was about a month or so ago.
A month or so ago. So, so my guess is it was probably a wolf. As David mentioned, and I don't want to rehash all of that, but it'd be very unlikely to be a coy wolf. But in the summertime, when they have their thin summer coats, I can see where that broader face would look more coyote-like because they don't have the full winter coat at that point. I'd be willing to guess that was still a wolf that you're seeing.
Yeah, and the really the only way, as I understand it, to determine it's a coy wolf is conduct a genetic analysis on it. Yeah, because you can't see from the exterior, the external physical features. You can't determine whether it's a coy wolf or not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don, thank you for calling. Tom and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Tom. Oh, I wonder if we lost Tom. He wanted to mention wildlife crossovers.
Oh, yeah.
For hibernate or animals that are on the move.
Yes. Yep. So near Banff, there are a number of, I don't even know what to call them, but they
wildlife
essentially
crossings, bridges.
Build a wildlife crossing. So it looks like a bridge, but there's no traffic on it. Mm-hmm. And they plant it in native vegetation. And so if you have time, you should take a look on the internet for wildlife crossings and you'll get a better picture of it. But essentially, it's infrastructure over a highway that looks in form very much like a bridge, but it's planted with all sorts of trees and shrubs and grasses. And they're using that to help funnel animals across, larger animals like bears and deer and things like that. And they can further funnel them by having fences along the highway that funnel them to these crossings.
And we just talked about this, and maybe that was the show a couple months ago. You weren't with me here for some reason. But the largest wildlife crossing in the world is currently being constructed in Southern California, over by Los Angeles. So, yeah, Google wildlife crossings, like Jamie mentioned, and it is really neat to see them. And when you're on top of them, I've been on top of one of those ones in Banff that goes over the Trans-Canada Highway. And they're so large and wide that you don't even realize you're on top of a highway because they're so vegetated. It's just like you're off in the middle of natural vegetation.
Yeah,
that's really cool. Karen in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Hi, Larry. You know I love your show.
Thank you.
There's more Karens in Madison than we know, I guess. But this is quick. There's a squirrel in my backyard of many that it's a gray squirrel, but it's got two white spots on its back, and there's nothing wrong with it. I just wondered if it's some new variant, or could it have just gone under a ladder while somebody was painting, or. You know, there is also some moss growing on, like, the bark of a birch tree back there is, and maybe something stuck on it. It's fine, but just question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of hard to see without, or to make a definitive answer, not looking at it. It's unusual to have fur in that coloring. But it's also possible somebody had trapped that squirrel and marked it and was interested in kind of keeping track of it and put some white paint on it. It could be a substance that it got into and is on there. There's lots of different things, but I don't think it was probably not likely a natural occurrence or coloring of the pelage. We see the black squirrels, albino squirrels. We see light colored squirrels where you have a gray squirrel with a really blonde tail, but not necessarily where you see a squirrel with white markings. So it could be that somebody had captured and marked it for their own reference. And who knows, you know, other possibilities.
Yeah, there's all kinds of them. Back to the this crossings of wildlife. Jill is reminding me, Jill Nadeau, our executive producer, is reminding me that we had Ben Goldfarb on the show.
Right.
And Ben wrote the book Crossings, which explains how roads are devastating wild animals and the solutions that might save them, essentially. You could go back to that interview. It's I think it was November 15th of 2023.
Yeah, that's a great book.
That's a great book, and it was really fun talking with Ben. And we have that up on our podcast. So if you go to the show, you can look that up.
Yeah.
November 15th, 2023. Steve in Evansville. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Hi, Larry.
Hi. What's on your mind?
We live out in the country, and we have a small woods behind our house. A number of years ago, I created a little puddle. It's like 5x5. And this year, we've been having a pair of saw-wet owls showing up. I have a trail camera set up. And I was just wondering about the prevalence of the saw-wet owls in Wisconsin.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. And they're a very small owl. I think it's the smallest owl we have in the state of Wisconsin. Do you know what color phase you're seeing?
Hard to say because it's always, I do like a 10-second video so we can watch them. We've caught them hunting and drinking from the puddle stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to say what color they are.
Yeah, they're really neat. Well, they come in a color phase of brown or red, and both color phases are relatively common. So that's really neat that you have them. They're a common species. You know, again, you just don't see them all that often because they're nocturnal. They're small, so they're easy to miss just because of their size. But you do hear them quite a bit, and that's pretty cool. They kind of have this hoarse whinny, and they have a scream. You may hear, many people may have heard them before and not recognize what they're actually listening to.
Yeah, I suspect that you adding that water feature is know, the reason why you're getting to see them as well. With the drought we mentioned earlier in the show and conditions, just adding that simple water feature has given you the opportunity to see them in your area.
Yeah, that's really cool. Thank you, Steve, for calling and letting us know. Rena in Madison has something for us. Hi, Rena.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I love to go hiking in Edna Taylor Conservancy, and there are quite a few indigenous Indian mounds in there that are protected. But I used to go in there before they were protected and didn't know any better, and I remember a panther mound. So here's my question. It's not about the mounds. It's about panthers. When did we have panthers in Wisconsin? And, I mean, it's not a bobcat. It's a panther.
Yeah. So that word panther is the same as a puma, as a mountain lion, as a cougar. So those are all the same animal. A lot of times it depends on where you are in the United States or sometimes in the world as to whether or not what that animal is going to be called. But there are pumas as its own species. There's a panther as its own species. And then we've got mountain lions and cougars, which is more or less the same animal, but different name. And sometimes we'll refer to pumas and panthers as mountain lions or cougars as well. So in Wisconsin, cougars or mountain lions are a native species, and historically they've been here until they were eradicated, both through human persecution, because obviously they're a large predator, and they will do some damage as you're trying to raise livestock, and certainly they will kill human beings, as they've done on rare occasion in different parts of the United States. But then they also, through habitat loss, they were not supported here in Wisconsin. So we are starting to have them come back. We've had a number of mountain lions in the state since, I think the first one was, 2008 or 6,
that's
somewhere
about
in
right.
there? Yeah,
yep.
Somewhere like that. And we hadn't had one prior to 2006 or 8 for decades. But what's happening is the mountain lion population in South Dakota is growing. And as that grows, those young males, so a male about a year or two of age, they get kicked out of the natal territory or the territory where they were raised by their mother. And so as that population in South Dakota grows, those young males have nowhere to go. So they start advancing out further and further west, east, north, south. And so the mountain lions we've had in the state of Wisconsin so far have been documented to be from that South Dakota population.
There you go. Thank you so much for that question and comment, Rena. Appreciate it. Joe in Medford called, said the DNR has talked about allowing deer hunters to leave field dressings in the field on public lands and just taking the meat and the trophy head or something. Is that going to be allowed in Wisconsin?
You know, I would definitely have to go and double check the regulations on that. So historically, you could field dress the animal in terms, leave the guts in the field, but
in terms of leaving the bones and everything else,
I'd have to look. I know there was some advisory questions
that came up.
I just don't know if it's been passed and is new. So, and that's a really great reminder with the hunting seasons coming up. There's the youth deer hunt this weekend. Archery season has started. It is time to crack open those regulations, and they usually have a summary page or two looking at what is new, what has changed. So it's a good reminder to do that, and I need to do that. So,
and on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist, and Professor Jamie Knack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, on the UW-Madison campus in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. Coming up, we're going to take a look at peregrine falcons. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to peregrine falcons. Like so many birds of prey, peregrine falcons have slowly recovered from going nearly extinct decades ago. Here in Wisconsin, there's been a nearly 40-year effort, and it's still underway to increase the number of nesting pairs of peregrines. And we're joined today by Greg Septon, founder of the Wisconsin Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project. It was launched in 1987. He's banded more than 1,300 wild-produced peregrines throughout our state. And as we talk with Greg, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the nesting and maybe the hunting habits of peregrine falcons? Have you seen a peregrine in the wild? You can join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Greg Septon, welcome, and thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
For nearly 40 years, you have directed a successful urban peregrine falcon recovery effort in Wisconsin. How did you get interested in this, and what continues to fascinate you about this very particular bird of prey?
Well, when I was a young kid in high school, I used to daydream about bringing peregrines back. They'd been gone for quite a while, and I had, you know, pipe dreams about putting a dome over the quarry in Racine and trying to get captive produced peregrines to nest on the cliffs in the quarry. And one thing led to another, and again, it was a good part of my life. There were no peregrines, and when I was at the Milwaukee Public Museum, I was able to eventually gather up some folks who had some interest and some money and initiate a recovery program with the releases of captive produced young. But going back to your original questions, I've always been intrigued by peregrines my whole life. So it was just kind of a natural extension of that interest and wanting to see them back because I wasn't able to see them as a kid. And today I can take my daughter out and show her peregrines pretty much any time I need to.
Yeah, that is very cool. So what's so fascinating? Talk about this bird.
They're the fastest animal on the planet. In a dive or a stoop, they can exceed 240 miles an hour. It's like watching a feathered bullet. They're extremely good parents. They've always been somewhat rare. They've been limited basically to available habitat, suitable habitat, I should say. And those were historically the cliffs overlooking the Mississippi River, the Wisconsin River, the Door Peninsula, and so on. So even historically, they were always rare. We probably had, you know, a couple dozen, maybe 30 pairs nesting in the state prior to their extirpation with DDT. So they've always been rare. There's been something special to see. A good friend of mine who helped head up peregrine recovery in Minnesota, Dr. Bud Tordoff, who was also a World War II flying ace, would always say, any day you see a peregrine is a good day. And that line has always stuck with me, and it's true. You're out all day, and if you're working and trying to find birds, you see a peregrine, it saves the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and at the time that you started this recovery project with 1987, what was the state of the population in the state?
We hadn't had peregrines nesting in the state for over 20 years, and I'd come up with an idea to try to get peregrines established along the western shore of Lake Michigan. The western shore of Lake Michigan is a major migratory path for a number of different species, but raptors in particular. And I thought if we could get peregrines nesting on human-built structures, tall human-built structures along that migratory route, we could do something to prime the pump and get a production facility, so to speak, going to pump out peregrines on an annual basis, to keep those sites active, obviously, but also to expand out and reoccupy some of the historical sites, the cliffs along the rivers, and so on.
And what is the known population of peregrines in Wisconsin today?
I can give you the numbers. I'm still working right now in this year's report trying to get some final numbers. But I'll give you the numbers for last year. Last year, we had 43 successful nests that produced a total of 125 young, which is probably one of our best years.
That is wonderful news. And banding, you have personally banded more than 1,300 peregrines. How do you do that?
It's approaching 1,500 this year. So I got next year I'll surpass 1,500, hopefully. I just get out, I monitor the sites, and find out when the eggs are laid. I determine when they're going to hatch so I can come back. Banding is critical. You want to make sure the birds are between about 18 to 22 or 20, 23 days of age. Any younger than that, they're sometimes difficult to sex. Any later than that, and they begin to get mobile, and you could inadvertently frighten them out of the nest box. So trying to determine that critical five-day window or six-day window is probably the most difficult part, and then it's just putting on a lot of miles and climbing.
You got to be putting on a heck of a lot of miles, especially you got to be burning up the roads there, because I assume that the nesting and so forth happens at roughly the same time for all the pairs.
Yeah, there's about a 3 or 4 week period where I don't get a lot of sleep, and there are days I drive 500 to 600 miles and band at 2 or 3 sites. So there's a crunch period, but it starts out slow and it peaks and then kind of tapers off a bit. So I've been doing it a long time. I actually look forward to it every spring, and I had a little setback this year. I got a new knee this summer because that was holding me back. So hopefully next year I'll be back on track and banding as many or more than ever, hopefully.
Anne in Jefferson has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Anne.
Oh, hello there. I've just got a remark, something my mother told me many years ago. I'm from Maryland, and she was from upstate New York. But anyhow, we were standing out in the yard, and she saw a bird fly over. And she said, look, it's a peregrine falcon. And she pronounced it like that. So we're little kids look up there saying, how can she see two green birds all the way up there? And we did not laugh because she'd walk this one. But because she mispronounced it. It was years before I realized it was peregrine. But I've been fascinated ever since then.
What a great story. Comment, Greg?
Well, it was a good day, wasn't it?
A pair of green falcons and wondering how they get two out there. That's a great story, Anne. Thank you for sharing that with us. That's really cool. You got something to share or a question? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. The banding process, you sort of mentioned it in passing, but it's got to be difficult a bit because you got to climb up there or get up there somehow. And then the birds themselves, you certainly don't want to be injuring them in any way.
No, you want to be careful, obviously. And there's two things. Human safety is incredibly important as well. So these adults are capable of giving you some problems. I've been hit a few times, but the few times I have been hit have, for the most part, been my own fault for not paying attention. But they can hit you. They can hurt you. They can draw blood. So you want to be careful. You don't want to get hurt yourself. And obviously, you don't want to hurt the young. So I very carefully gather them up out of the nest boxes, put them into a small air kennel or carrier. And I generally bring them indoors where it's safer to do the banding. I have done a number of sites out on the rooftops and things where there are adults, but I try to keep them settled down as much as possible and band away from the nest box whenever possible.
And the cliff edges, do you actually collect on cliff edges? I can see you doing it on the top of a building because you can get up there, but cliff edge.
I personally don't band that many cliffs. I've only banded a few of them. A number of the cliffs in Wisconsin are banded by folks from the Raptor Resource Project. But they'll rappel off the side of the cliff, and then they'll bring the young up again in a small carrier. And the banding is generally done on the top of the cliff. And then once they're completed, the young are lowered back down to the eyrie and placed back on the ledge.
Very, very, very cool. Cindy in Amherst emailed a photo they took of a peregrine perched on a gas station in Marquette, Michigan, this past February. It's a beautiful shot, and right on top of the gas station sign. How is the distribution around the nation in terms of peregrines?
They're fairly widespread. We have a very good population here in the upper Midwest. There's, of course, the Rocky Mountain population and the Pacific Coast population. The East Coast, we've got a lot of peregrines. You don't see them in the Deep South as much as you do here in this part of the country, but they're pretty widespread. You're not going to see them on the Great Plains, generally speaking. again, you're going to find them where there's available habitat, and that includes natural cliffs, but it also includes human-built cliffs, so to speak, the buildings we've built, the bridges, the grain elevator complexes, small or tall smokestacks associated with industry and power plants, et cetera. So there are a lot of human-built cliffs, per se, that are available today as nest sites, and peregrines have adapted to these and use them on a regular basis now.
Yeah, we have at least a pair, do we not, in our capital city?
Right, you have a pair that nests at the MG&E, the Madison Gas and Electric Power Plant.
Yeah, which is pretty cool, and it's great to see. I've seen them. Especially like on a Saturday morning at the farmer's market downtown.
Right.
You might see them there. Greg Sefton, our guest today, talking about his work with peregrine falcons. And if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in or an experience to share. I'd love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at peregrine falcons today with Greg Sefton, a perfect person to be talking to because he's a falconer and founder of the Wisconsin Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project. He launched it back in 1987. Former director of the Natural History Outreach Section of the Milwaukee Public Museum. Give a call, 800-642-1234, or shoot an email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Mike in Madison next. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a question about how many birds are banded in the city here in Madison, because I have three that I see in my backyard all the time, and I don't think, well, I know I saw three juveniles, two males and a female, in the same time in a tree, so I know there's three in my backyard in Madison on the northeast side, and I'm just wondering, I don't think they're flying in. Then this year there was another three juveniles, same thing, two males and a female, and there's been two adults hanging out. And so there's a lot of falcons I see just in my backyard. So how many do we have actually banded here in Madison? And what do you think our estimate is for in this area?
First of all, there are these raptors you're seeing in your backyard. Are they coming towards bird feeders at all? Are they feeding on chipmunks or other animals in the backyard?
Oh, yes, they have decimated the bird feeders this year. I usually go through a gallon to 2 gallons a week of feed, and I'm down to a gallon every other week now.
The reason I ask that is it's very likely the birds you're seeing are Cooper's hawks, which have become incredibly urbanized, and that one of their habits is visiting bird feeders and going from yard to yard and getting breakfast, lunch, and dinner in that manner. They're very adept at it. They become very common. A number of these birds have been banded, but they're not banded to the extent that peregrines are these days.
So what is how does a peregrine get its food?
Peregrines hunt the open skies. They take their prey, generally speaking, in the air. Again, in these classic high-speed stoops or dives, they're very efficient. And again, the birds are taken out of midair.
Oh, so that's how they usually get there. Most often, 90% of the time, at least, I would guess.
The 90% or more. There's one instance that always makes me laugh about up at the Edgewater Generating Station, where there was a pair of pigeons that had nested in a small recessed area at the top of an I-beam near the roof of the plant. And the male peregrine, of course, that was nesting there that particular year was very opportunistic. He discovered he could walk down that I-beam, walk into the opening, and grab baby pigeons out of the nest and bring them back and feed his young. So, again, they can be opportunistic like any animal, but generally speaking, they take their prey in stoops.
Oh, really interesting. David in Zion, Illinois, we'll go to you. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
I had a cousin in the country here in northern Illinois who had a peregrine falcon, and the highlight of our visit was always to watch him interact with this bird. It was really amazing, and for those who've not been up close to one of these magnificent animals that God created, I really feel sorry for them because they're really being cheated because it's really a wonderful animal.
What was your cousin's name?
Let's see. His name was Steve Ball.
Okay, that about right. I don't recognize. I know a number of falconers. I know people who work with peregrines. That's why I was curious. But no, I don't recognize that name.
Interesting, interesting though. And they are beautiful animals. The Wisconsin Falcon Watch 2023 peregrine report. I just love going through that you put together, of course, Greg. And the photos of the peregrine are stunning photos, lots of them.
It's a labor of love. It generally takes about 4 or 5 months to put the report together, but I like doing it. As long as I can continue to do so, I will.
Yeah, they're just stunning photos and a lot of really interesting information. Bill in Sheboygan, I believe, is up next. Bill, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, we do a lot of motorcycle riding and enjoy watching the birds. But the question I have is the difference between a male and female peregrine falcon. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. How do you tell the male from the female?
Yeah, the difference is basically size. The males are about a third smaller than the females. Oftentimes they have a paler coloration. The back is more of a, generally speaking, is more of a powdery blue, whereas the adult females' backs are more of a grayish blue. They vary, and you get crossover between the two as far as markings go. But generally speaking, I'll go by size. And you know, if you see the same birds up back and forth, you can start to make comparisons, and it gets to be pretty easy to identify, you know, males from females and from the markings generally.
Yeah. Philippa in Madison, it's your turn now. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I've been following Trudy and Melvin for many, many years at the MG&E nest box in downtown Madison. And I've seen many of their chicks get banded, and then they fly away, and that's the last you see of them. And I wonder, because there have been a lot I've been quite fond of, and whether they've ever turned up healthy and happy somewhere else.
Yeah.
We have a lot of the young that banded that do turn up and nest elsewhere. Some of the birds from Madison have nested elsewhere here in Wisconsin. Some have nested in other states. Peregrines have a first-year mortality rate of 50 to 70%. So if they get beyond that first year, they do fairly well. I've had peregrines that I've banded. In fact, we had one here banded last year, I think it was, year before last year, that ended up down in Nicaragua. I've had another peregrine that ended up in Venezuela. So we find out a lot about how far they travel. There's also peregrines I've banded as babies in nest boxes that have survived to live to be 13 and 14 years of age, and I banded all their babies. So you can tell a lot about a bird. You can find out how long they live, what their lifetime production is, dispersal, where their young go, how long their young live, so on and so forth. So banding is important. I want to continue doing it as long as I'm able. We continue to learn more and more every year.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Tom in Madison wonders how much competition is there among peregrines, red-tailed hawks, and Cooper's hawks. How much pressure do they place on each other for habitat and food?
They all have different habitat requirements, and they all nest in the different situations. You'll see red tails nesting in, you know, deciduous forests and woodlots along farm fields. You'll also see them nesting on structures in the city. Cooper's hawks, you'll see nesting in woodlots, you know, parks in the cities and so on and so forth. Peregrines, generally speaking, nest up high. They're going to be up high on a building, on a human-built structure, up on a cliff. So there's not really a lot of competition between the three species. And when they do interact, the peregrines generally end up coming on, ending up on the top of the heap, so to speak, because in the air, there's really not much that can compete with a falcon.
I wouldn't think so. Well, you're a falconer yourself. Do you have your own peregrine that you work with, or how does that work?
No, I'm not a falconer now. I grew up flying goshawks and redtails and prairie falcons, but I don't have birds now. I much more enjoy being with peregrines, working with peregrines every year, banding young. I get my falcon fixed that way, so to speak.
Okay. Austin in Ironwood, Michigan emailed to say they work in Ashland, Wisconsin, and several years ago, peregrines began nesting on the large ore dock reaching into Lake Superior. Because the dock was due to be demolished and the fact that the terns there were being eaten by the peregrine, efforts were put forth to keep the falcons from nesting on the dock. Eventually, the falcons moved on and the dock was taken down.
Right. Those peregrines, if I recall correctly, moved to the power plant. There's also a power plant in Ashland, the XL of Energy Bayfront plant, and they've been nesting there since.
It's
an interesting point, because one of the things that in the urban population that you have to deal with is that a lot of these sites don't last forever. Buildings come and go. Buildings are torn down. Power plants, as you may well be aware, are going by the wayside. Coal-fired power plants are going by the wayside. So what I've spent a lot of time doing is looking for replacement sites. When a power plant goes down, I try to find something nearby that is suitable and then work with those property owners or building owners to get a nest box built in that structure in effort to draw the peregrines from the old site to the new site. Now, I've been fairly successful. We have a new site down in Pleasant Prairie that replaced the Pleasant Prairie power plant. We have a new site in Sheboygan at the Burt Malt site that it's set up and operating now. So when the Edgewater Generating Station does come down, we've got a backup site. So trying to keep this population stable requires making sure that we have quote-unquote replacement sites to those sites that we lose.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, as I read your report, it was intriguing to me to see your listing of sites and so forth, and you had there'd be nest fail site or temporary site. And I wondered about those designations, actually.
Well, if the site fails, it means there were eggs were laid that didn't hatch.
Okay.
And as far as the temporarily occupied sites, these peregrines in the springtime do a lot of moving around. They'll go from site to site, and oftentimes you'll end up with territorial battles where a visiting falcon will come in and battle with the resident falcon and either get chased off or take over that site. So in the springtime, when hormone levels are high, they move around until they can find a place to nest, establish a territory. And once they've established a territory, as long as they survive, they'll come back year after year. But again, in the springtime, there's a lot of movement between sites. The urge to nest is quite strong, and these peregrines move around quite a lot.
Tom in Oshkosh, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, thanks. Wonderful show. For a long time, we lived on Lake Mendota, and one morning we got a phone call from our neighbor saying, look slowly out your window. You'll see a pair of peregrine falcons. And they were there pretty much for weeks to months. I don't remember how long. I just remember they were there, and there was a cliff going down to the lake of about 35 feet. But they were about less than 20 feet from our bedroom window. And I was trying to two things. I don't recall how long that nesting period was. And the other one was the acute lack of songbirds that summer.
You said there was an actual cliff, 30-foot cliff or a ledge by the river, by the lake?
Yeah.
Do you have any images? Yeah. Did you take any photos of those birds?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Did you take any photos of those birds?
We did, but they're on a phone from long ago. It would take me a while to retrieve it.
If there's a ledge there along the lake, I'd love to see those birds, see pictures, and make sure they're peregrines.
Yeah, that would be a good thing. Tom, thank you so much for calling. And Greg, the time has flown by. I want to thank you so much for all of the work that you've done with peregrine falcons. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And by the way, I had Bill Volkert on the show yesterday, and he wanted to be sure to say hi to you. Greg?
Bill, Bill's a good guy. Hi, Bill.
Greg, thank you so much. Greg Septon, falconer, founder of the Wisconsin Peregrine Recovery Program. Great to have him with us. Thank you so much for listening in. And a big thanks to our whole team, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, and, of course, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in, and stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.